Have you ever noticed that you stand or walk differently when you're feeling more confident or at ease with yourself? Well, today I'm delighted to be talking to Thomas Kamper, who has helped thousands of people positively transform how they think and feel by developing body awareness. So if you'd like to find out how you can develop more confidence and feel better about yourself, then please stay tuned.
Genau.
Welcome to this episode of the Mind, Body and Relationship Maze. I'm really very excited to be talking to Dr. Thomas Kamper, who is Professor of Somatic Performance and Education at Bath Spa University. So, Thomas has worked with movement, with dance, theater and live art for the last 30 years as a performer, as a choreographer, director and educator. Thomas has taught somatic approaches towards movement education in different settings around the world. Thomas is originally trained as a visual artist in Germany and then as a dancer at the Laban Center and Middlesex University in London. He's worked with London-based Jewish-Austrian Ausdruckstanz pioneer Hilde Holger for 13 years, and he's had many international artist collaborations, for example, with the choreographer Liz Agus or the playwright Julia Pascal. Thomas is a very qualified teacher of the Feldenkrais method, which forms a foundation for his teaching and informs his research and artistic practice greatly. So let's start this interview by you telling me a little bit more about your work, Thomas, if that's okay.
Thank you, Angela. It was really... Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very well.
Because I can't see the. now I can see something on this on the monitor. Great.
Okay.
It's lovely to be interviewed by you. I've been working with movement as a creative person, maybe since I was 18 years old, 19 years old. I originally studied visual art in Germany. Okay. And I, by accident, more or less by accident, got involved in attending a theater workshop when I was 18, 19 years old by people from the French theater company Théâtre du Soleil, which was a company run by a director called Ariane Mnouchkine. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with a kind of poetic movement practice, a practice right, that was concerned with sensation, feeling, movement qualities, creativity, movement for theater. And I had no idea really what that was and what they were doing and why they were doing what they were doing. And before that, I had always been a sports person.
Oh, right. I didn't know that.
Because I was quite small. Hello? Yeah. Because I was quite small and thin, and I always suffered. I always felt kind of bullied as a young man in a sports context. So I kind of withdrew from the competitive world of sports and athletics, and then was extremely happy to find a different approach to moving. Mm-hmm. In theater, which wasn't about competition, and it wasn't about Leistung, it wasn't about achievement necessarily, but it was about the experience of self and the experience of movement itself.
Mm. And how did that help you at the time, Thomas?
Oh, wow. I think it gave me another sense of identity.
Right. Yeah.
I was just thinking about it earlier on. I think from my generational upbringing as a German young male of a kind of post-war generation, it was very difficult to find an embodied identity. An embodied male identity that had nothing to do with violence. I felt violated. Literally, I felt violated in my organismic self, and to arrive with at these kind of practices was something completely new. I suddenly had an access to my bodiness, my playfulness again. It was like revisiting a childhood. Accessing a curiosity and self-love and feelings in myself through my body were wide open. Intense and they were not part of a kind of mainstream conformist body image that you perhaps were supposed to develop as a male creature in that particular society.
How did that impact in terms of the way that you said your identity? How did that impact the way that you saw yourself, how you experienced yourself?
Well, I think it. I mean, this is now 40 years after I experienced these things. I think it reaffirmed a self-love.
Right.
It reaffirmed a sense of dignity, a sense of empowerment in myself, an embodied I can,
right,
rather than a consistent sense of embodied you're not good enough,
right, yes,
or this is not good enough, or a sense of an embodied you should, this became something completely different. It was suddenly an embodied I can, an embodied I could, an embodied why not.
Great.
And a great sense of pleasure.
Yes, yeah, I can imagine that. And then how did you get into teaching? Because then you started to work at a university. I don't know when you
Yes,
when
so,
you started
so I already trained, I also trained as a school teacher in Germany, but I felt I didn't really want to teach art, or I also trained in English language. So I didn't want to go into school. And when I finished my training, I decided not to go into school teaching, but I worked with a children's theater company for 3 or 4 years, and I was running a youth theater. But again, I wasn't so much interested in the kind of traditional theater. What I was really more interested was embodied practice and choreography, really. Movement as a resource for theater. And that job ran out, and I decided to, or in between, I had already studied dance. In that period, I already discovered kind of modern dance practices. And I decided to retrain, and I decided to come to the UK and to study dance. And while I was a student, after I studied at the Laban Center, I got involved in a small dance organization called Chisenhill Dance Space in the East End. And became part of a collective of what was called New Dance at the time. A kind of somatic oriented kind of dance practice, independent dance practice, which was a self-organized studio where young choreographers and young dance makers were kind of working with more experienced people and working together. And through that, I got my first teaching job. I was attending a class by a wonderful teacher called Mary Prestige. And after a few months, she said, "Do you want to take over the class?" And so I started taking over the class. I immediately felt this is something I would love to do. I love doing, and this is an opportunity for me. And then the next situation emerged that one of my ex-teachers said, "Thomas, there is a job at an acting school. I know you've worked also with theater, and I don't want to do that job. It's a job teaching Laban movement analysis and Laban based practices, and I was trained in that approach. It's a structural analysis of movement." And I went for an interview and got the job, and then I started teaching in 1988 at East 15 Acting School, which was a conservatoire movement for actors.
Right.
And I worked there for 2 years, and I taught 10 classes a week in within 2 days. So I was teaching one class after the other class, after the next class, after the next class.
Right.
And got myself the experience of becoming professional in what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I was still studying, still learning, still discovering.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was offered jobs through a choreographer who I worked with for a longer period, Liz Agis. And she asked me to work for her in Brighton, at first at the theatre school, theatre department at the University of Brighton, and then to run all the practical sessions at the creative dance program at University of Brighton, which was a program that combined visual arts and dance practices.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
So it just fit the bill where I was coming from. I came from visual art and theater background into dance, and I didn't bring the kind of traditional dance discipline and dance aesthetics perhaps into the teaching, and that's what they were interested in.
Right.
And then through that, I was alerted that there was a job at Chichester, at University of Chichester. And I applied for the job, and it was a permanent position in the dance department, and I got the job. And I got the job because they had seen my work. They had seen me as a performer and as a choreographer. They'd seen me in different contexts, but I wasn't aware of that. So they knew also about the artistic work I'd been involved with. And I was there for 9 years teaching in the dance department, teaching experiential anatomy, teaching holistic approaches to movement as a resource for dancers. I'll come back to that in a second. And teaching choreographic practices.
Right.
And I think what I was teaching there was what we now call somatic practices or somatic informed dance practices, and somatic practices are really...
Yeah, can you explain that a little bit? That's what I was going to say, thank you.
So somatic practices are really movement approaches that were developed in the middle of the 20th century or even at the beginning of the 20th century in Europe and in the United States, which are practices that are concerned with self-direction.
Right.
Self-discovery, your own somatic authority, bringing you back to your own improved self-image, where the teacher gives a lot of time for your own exploration rather than giving you answers or correctives and tells you exactly how to do what to do. They are often inductive processes, meaning they give you a stimulus to begin with, and then it's about you to discover your own inner sensorial world in relationship to how you're interacting with the world.
Could you give us an example here that might be quite interesting? So if you were to instruct somebody in somatic practice, what might you ask them to do?
Well, so first of all, we often, or I teach a particular approach, or I'm informed by a variety of approaches, but I'm quite influenced by an approach called the Feldenkrais method, which is a system. It's a system developed by a Russian-born Israeli scientist who was a judo master, and who was also affiliated with a lot of early European gymnastics practices, like the work of Elsa Gindler or the work. So it came kind of, it was affiliated to the kind of Gindler practice, to the Menzendieck practice, kind of proto-feminist practices. And one of the things that we do is... we give time for what we called a body scan. So we give time for people just to sit or to lie down and to take some time to attend to yourself. Take some time, take some moment to just sense what you can sense in yourself. If you put your attention inwards, What does it feel like to be you? And can you scan through yourself? Can you make a little journey inside of yourself and maybe visit different places in yourself? So we give this time for body scanning. Mm-hmm. And then we might give a little body puzzle, a little exercise for it, or not really an exercise. We might give a little task for exploration, and we might give a whole composition of tasks for exploration. Let's say we might ask someone to roll their head from the right to the middle to the left, and to slow that down and to begin to notice, is it easier to roll the head to the right or is it easier to roll the head to the left? And then we might ask them to put their feet up to standing and let their knees drop from the right to the left slowly. And then we might ask them again, what are they noticing? Is it easier to drop their weight from the right to the right or to the left? And then we let them combine the head rolling from the right to the left with the knee dropping. And we asked more and more questions about how the ribs are involved in the rolling process, how the pelvis is involved. And we asked questions in relationship to qualities. And so on the one hand, as in these somatic practices, you are you're making connections. I was talking to someone recently who I'm going to co-teach with, and we came up with a class which we just called Reconnections. And and I think that an essence of the work is that we're giving time for the learner or for the participant in the session to reconnect with themselves again. And that first and foremost means a reconnection with their thinking, sensing and feeling, with action, a reconnection with their embodiedness, their fleshy sense of self, to then also work on finding connections within our bodies or our embodiment. So often we see that our students or clients, that they have, that they're not as connected as they could be, that their sensing isn't as schooled as their doing, or their doing isn't as schooled as their sensing. And we're connecting their sensing with their doing and their ability to reflect and with their ability to do. And then the next step is to look at how the organism is connected within. So maybe the legs are not well coordinated into the pelvis. They're not as connected into the pelvis as they ideally could be.
So it's very detailed.
We're beginning to explore. It's very detailed. And so we're working from a kind of body-mind connectedness into an intra-organismic connectedness. And then we're looking at how does my bodiness connect to my interaction with the world. So the last element, if you wish, of the connectivity that we're practicing is an integration into the everyday life. So that we're beginning to ask questions, well, what does this feel like? How do you feel now when you come off your mat and when you walk through space? Or do you feel lighter, heavier? Is this easier to walk? When you're turning, what's it feel like when you turn and stand? Do you feel more confident, less confident? Does this feel more urgent, or do you feel more laid back?
And are there some, I'm sort of curious about what kind of, I'm sorry, I've got a slight delay here, Thomas.
Yeah, no, do interrupt. I'm getting carried away.
I'm really sorry about that. No. I lost you there for 1 second. So I'm just sort of curious. It just sounds so interesting, so fascinating. And I can imagine you get a range of responses from the students and the clients you work with. Are there some examples, I wonder, that you could give us about how this has impacted on someone's life? Did they walk away differently? Did they experience the world differently?
Yes. I mean, I think it very often has a very strong impact on people. In a way, as it had on me when I was 18.
Exactly.
or later on when I did the Feldenkrais training in my 40s, where I felt after the training, I don't even remember who I was before I did the training. I'm a completely different person, or I have a completely different sense of self. Or I am a different sense of self. I am a different sensing of self. Yes, in many different ways. In many different ways. Students say, "Wow, I feel I'm a much better mover." On the most simple level, I've become interested in becoming a better mover, or I am so much more flexible now, or I feel so much more interested in movement.
Right.
Very often people say I feel really interested in myself now. I've developed a self-interest and a curiosity towards my own self-care.
Yeah.
Which is really, really exciting. People feel it provides a greater sense of awareness and a greater sense of ease in their interaction with the world on an everyday level, whether they want to take a book out of a shelf or whether they want to have a conversation with someone. A lot of the work we're doing is about reactivating the mobility of the pelvis and of the abdomen and of the chest and of our whole core and working with a much greater sense of detail, of bringing back sensation into places in the organism that have lost sensation, or we're bringing back a sense of ease and a sense of pleasure into places that have been imaged with sensations of abuse or defense or hardness. So often the effect of this work is profound, and it affects people's sexuality. It affects people's confidence. Many times, I mean, I teach in private, or let me rewind a little bit. I teach a lot in performing arts contexts. That's the majority of the work that I do is this work in combination with dance processes or theater processes. So there's a whole creative aspect to it that normally isn't necessarily embedded in these practices. So people come, I've taught ballet dancers who come back to me and they say they've never felt themselves before. They've only saw themselves in the mirror. They've only seen themselves in the mirror. And they were always told they're not good enough. So suddenly they perceive themselves from within. And suddenly they perceive themselves from within with a sense of peace and ease and pleasure. And there is a teacher who doesn't challenge, doesn't indoctrinate them with a kind of negative language, with a domineering language, but with a language that supports questions, all the kind of psychotherapy tricks of using language, of pacing and enhancing and going with what's going on. I'm very observant in the process that I try to be really as a pedagogue with the process of the student as much as I can, as much as I can observe. So for a lot of traditionally trained dancers or theater people, it's like an explosion of arriving in themselves and developing an inner authority. And that's the main reason why we do it now, in a way, in the training, because we are trying to educate students from a contemporary democratic point of view, which demands citizens which have a sense of autonomy in who they are and have a sense of inner authority of being able to make informed decisions from what they believe and what they think is useful for them or is ethically good for them, rather than just being told consistently from the outside what is right or wrong and how they should be doing what they're doing.
Right.
So this ability to make decisions from within is again a discovery for students.
Yes, a very different way of working, I imagine. A very different way of working, yes. I imagine, for most of the students to have that kind of freedom of exploration. Yeah. And yes. I imagine it impacts greatly and can completely transform their practice as dancers, as performers. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, the incredible thing is I come back to when I was teaching in Chichester in 1993 till 2002. I was teaching these processes there. And I constantly felt I was in a battle with some of my colleagues. I felt constantly what I'm doing is at the margins and I shouldn't be doing this. This isn't proper disciplinarian practice.
Right.
And my feminist bosses, they really wanted me to do this kind of work, which I don't think I really understood the connections then. Now I understand them much better. I came back 10 years after or 20 years after, 15 years after I was teaching there, and somatic practices are now the mainstream.
Interesting.
In Chichester, for example, most of the teachers use somatics as a way and somatic pedagogical ethics as a way into developing their pedagogies. They have a professor for somatic practices who now resigned because she retired now. And I have coached one of their members of staff in writing academic journal articles about their emerging pedagogies. So it's become part of the mainstream education. I'm now invited into conservatoire teaching in dance schools all over the world to do this kind of work. Because the work has also been theorized and therefore validated in a kind of pedagogical contexts, and the proof is in the pudding.
Absolutely.
Students are generally very happy with what they're experiencing through these kind of practices, and it improves their performance, and it creates a more sustainable and someone wrote about this, and it creates a sustainable vulnerability as a mover. So you don't just want a sustainable athleticism and a sustainable robot, but for dancers and even more for theater people, you want a sustainable access to their embodied and psychophysical vulnerability. And
so you want performers to really know themselves, inside out, so to speak.
Yes. I mean, so now in my main job at Bath Spa University, I teach students of acting, and it's been very successful. The process has been very successful. I've done this work for since 1988, so I've had a lot of experience to learn, and I've become a leader in the field. And it's been going very well with the students. It's always difficult to begin with.
What's the resistance?
When the students arrive and they think, there is a sense of resistance or confusion.
What's he doing with
Or let's say it like this, the first few weeks, it's all still very exciting and different, and students are really talking about their extraordinary discoveries they're making in themselves, because they never paid. They are British colonial subjects. We are not in Italy, or we are not in Brazil. These are not students who have English students. They don't have access to their sense of embodied sense of self whatsoever.
Yes, absolutely.
Or not whatsoever, but to a very minimal sense that the young men are 18 years old, and their posture is already fixed and collapsed, and there's no dynamism in their sense of gesture out into space. They are introvert, they are limited in their physical ability and capacity, and suddenly we are softening and opening the possibilities here to expand and to expand into their inner space, and then also to expand into their outer space. And it's an amazing experience for the students.
Yeah, what a process. What a fantastic opportunity for the students.
Yeah.
Yeah, to experience themselves in that way, to learn something about themselves. Absolutely. And what a new way.
But then, of course, a lot of students asking, what a new way of experience. Yes, but then a lot of students are asking themselves, well, why are we doing this? What's the point? What am I getting out of? They want kind of a measurable or tangible results often,
right? Yeah.
Because they are that's where they're coming from. You know, how do I assess them? How do I measure them? What can I do? What can I do to get a first grade result? You know.
Sure.
And
that's the system, so, of course. Yeah.
It's a whole education system. So I was talking a lot. I work now with a colleague who I've been working with also for 20 years off and on. And she's also a Feldenkrais practitioner. And we're kind of sharing these processes, and we're talking a lot about it. And you know, where I keep saying, you know, we're battling against a whole culture of disembodiment. And another colleague of mine wrote a whole book about the age of re-embodiment, and I suddenly understood something, and that I'm not just teaching embodiment, I'm not just teaching somatic practices, but what we're actually doing is we're working with processes of re-embodiment in a culture that historically and politically disembodies its Absolutely. Subjects. So that's and it does it in a digital age. Yeah. So it does it that the students have their hour with me, or they have their hour with my colleague Jackie, where they do these kind of things and they're in themselves. And they're with each other, and we work a lot through touch when we can. I'll come back to that as well, which is then the great transformer, really.
Yeah.
But as soon as the students are out of the studio, they will be in front of their phones. They'll be in front of their phones, and their posture goes inwards, their head is dropped down, and the attention is outside of their physical selves. The attention is on the screen, and they're back in that world of disembodied conditioning. So it's difficult to maintain this.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And of course now, normally when I work with the students in Bath, then in the first semester, it's about self-exploration. We're giving some creative tasks for students also to take some time on their own to create something, so that they are learning to be their own self-director. And then in the second semester, it's all about touch, and it's all about engaging with another creature. It's about, I teach students handling techniques, bodywork techniques, and we start with the with the handling of kind of safe places, perhaps. We work with safe touch, listening touch, affirmative touch, and really just weight bearing, simply holding someone's leg or holding someone's arm, and then gently guiding someone and allowing yourself to be touched, allowing yourself to be guided. And then we're working also on them touching their core, their pelvis, their tummies, their chests, their shoulders, their heads, and coming more towards the middle and developing this sense of professional intimacy. And then we're working with lifting and carrying and very, very close, strong, firm, and yet sensitive contact practices. You can't lift someone if you don't hug them around the pelvis or below their buttocks. You have to go below their buttocks and hug them very tight and press them against your groin or press them against your tummy. So you are learning to engage with someone in these very intimate ways, non-abusive and non-dominant and non-sexual ways. And yet you are in touch with your sexuality. You all the time need to negotiate this. And that's extraordinary when the students are engaging
particularly through
the touch practices.
Particularly for the age group that you described earlier on, for young people 18, 19, 20, that would be extremely powerful for the rest of their lives.
Powerful, extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, when I arrived there in the first year at Bath Spa, and I was straight away teaching the second years, and they had someone before who was just doing fitness exercises with them and drilling them. And here we were exploring and we're rolling on the floor and we're revisiting developmental patterns. We're revisiting childhood movements, and we are making contact with the floor, and then we're making contact with each other, and we are listening, and we're leaning and molding into each other and observing each other and just being with each other. And then every session we end up in a circle. We sit together in a circle, and there's a kind of reflective process, which I tend to kind of highlight that we have this kind of experiential learning model where people self-reflect, but they also reflect on the bigger picture, and they reflect as a collective at the end. And students were saying, wow, this is just so extraordinary. This is so different from the way we were trained. Now we're becoming educated, and this is about us together. And I understand that this is not about being in competition with my peers, but it's about a sharing of being together and a sharing of creating together. And so we are, we're working on collaborative practice, of course. And normally in the second year, what I do is then I teach acrobatics. I teach the students acrobatics. And in the end, all of the students can do it in one way or another. So if they can't do the backflip over someone on their own, then they'll do this with two people assisting and holding them. And they are, so they're learning to be humble. They're also learning to not achieve. They're learning to come to their limits and to realize, I can't do this on my own. I have to ask for help. I'm actually the heavy one. You know, I can't be standing on someone's shoulders because I'm much heavier than that person. So that person has to stand on my shoulders. And they're coming to a reality of themselves, which isn't always pleasant. And that's also really, really important. Whereas in the first year, it's very much about developing perhaps a self-love and a pleasant experience in themselves and developing ease in themselves and finding ease and celebrating that, And then in the second year, it's also very much about the world is problematic. And how do I cope in a resilient and robust way with my limits? We have 30% of our students have mental health issues. Right. 30% of our, and the mental health issues are always manifested in their embodied sense of self.
Of course.
And we have students who are filled up to the top of the head with medication and with all sorts of medication and with all sorts of diagnoses and of from schizophrenia to paranoia, whatever they're labeled as. And these practices can be, I have witnessed extraordinary transformation of students.
Yes.
Where they arrive in the first year and you think, wow, this student just won't last. This student has got so many problems. And by the end of the third year, they're the best students.
Yeah,
and they have taken this work on, and they've reinvented themselves. They rewired themselves. They found the synapses in the brain and the neurotransmitters, without their chemicals, without their medication, through the embodied practices. Yeah.
Sorry to come in there, Thomas. No, and it's really interesting because, of course, this is so relevant.
I'm losing
to
you.
A lot of the content. Can you still hear me? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes,
I can. Sometimes it cuts out.
Yeah, the connection is not good. This is so relevant to a lot of the work in counseling and psychotherapy as well, where we're working increasingly with the body. Obviously, the 60s introduced the whole idea of 50s, 60s of working more with the body. And you're so right, getting people to drop into their body to have that experience can have a huge impact on their mental health as well.
Gosh.
I can just imagine that a lot of your students would benefit greatly from the work that you do with them. Oh. Not just on a physiological level, but also in terms of their psychic processes, in terms of their mental health.
Yes.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yes. And I mean, for example, I mean, the Feldenkrais method that I'm kind of subscribing to or work with, you know, it has two systems. One is a hands-on system called functional integration. Mm-hmm. And function isn't meant as a simple biomechanical functioning, but actually function is determined as or is defined as an ability to do what you want to do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you are able to do the things you want to do with a sense of greater ease, then you've improved your functioning. And that is understood as a psychophysical social process.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, Feldenkrais talks about a fundamental unity of body, mind, and environment. And the environment is a social and sexual environment. It is a environment that it's an environment with me in a natural but also social environment, and it's an environment that involves desire, and it involves rejection, and it involves attraction and repulsion. It involves a desiring psyche, and it involves other people. Right. And that's also how we kind of approach the hands-on work. Mm-hmm. That the hands-on work is not a body work, but it's a person through touch interacting with another person through their body. So it's a person-to-person touching where I lift their arm and I feel, is that comfortable for that person, and where does that person allow me to go here, and I might then stop that and ask questions, did you notice and what happened there for you and how did that feel. So we are I'm 100% sure this is very close to psychotherapy processes. And, you know, Feldenkrais was familiar with the work of Milton Erickson, and he was part of the Esalen scene. So a lot of people exchanged their working methodologies in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, when he was very active. It comes out of the kind of humanist and human potential movement. We are not working in reductionist ways. We are working in person-to-person interaction. Yeah. And then the second practice working in group practices.
Sorry, I had a delay there again, Thomas. Yeah, we've got to sort of slowly come to an end. Yeah, I was just thinking as you were talking, this is so relevant. A lot of the methodology that you describe and the practices that you describe, they would be so wonderful, particularly when we're talking about relationships and how, you know, if couples could integrate some of that work into the relationships, how wonderful would that be? A very different experience. Yes. I think there's room here, particularly I'm thinking in terms of, you know, couples training, etc., to integrate a lot more of the work that you do. It's fascinating and it would be really helpful.
Yeah, of course. And there are many other processes. I mean, I work a lot with a process that's called contact improvisation, which is a postmodern dance form, which is all about touch, where you're all the time in touch and following each other, and you're becoming very skillful, basically, in communicating.
Yeah.
And you're becoming rich and full. You're becoming rich and full in who you are. As an embodied being, you're becoming relational.
Absolutely.
I think one of my wonderful colleagues, Glenna Batson, who is a senior colleague of mine, she wrote about that the somatic practices, including this contact improvisation and the Feldenkrais method, that they are providing us with a relational body.
Yes.
With a kind of open systems understanding, dynamic systems understanding, open systems understanding of what it means to be in the world and what it means to make choices in the world and to be also able to attend to and respond to the other.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. What it means to be in relationship, in relation to other people, absolutely, Okay.
Yeah, so it's all exciting. I mean, it's exciting to talk about it.
Yes, I could be talking to you for hours about it. I find it absolutely fascinating. It's just been so interesting. I'm sure there's many more questions. And if you have time, Thomas, some other time, let's do another interview.
I mean, the shocking thing is I've been teaching only online through Zoom or through Google Meet since March. So all these things I was talking about, acrobatics, touch, hands-on work with students, and it's gone completely out of the window. So there's a different mode of learning now, and I don't know what this means yet, to have this digital somatics now happening in the classroom.
that's a whole new branch that you need to write about.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, it's just been such a delight talking to you. So, so interesting. I could listen to this for hours. I find it really, really interesting. So thank you so much. Thomas, hopefully we'll talk again. Thanks to all of our listeners who will be listening in today. So make sure that you subscribe, that you share, that you tune into the next episode of our podcast. You can find out more about the Relationship Maze at therelationshipmaze.com. That's our online program. And there will be more, plentiful, more interesting episodes to come in our podcasts. But for today, just thank you, Thomas. Absolutely wonderful, wonderful interview. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. If you'd like to find out more about creating great relationships, go to therelationshipmaze.com, and I look forward to seeing you there. And remember to tune in to the next podcast.